totally at the World Cup.
Welcome, everybody. Do not be touching anything.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable this.
Up day 7, Uruguay and Russia through, but Morocco horror show as North Africans go Russian home, victims of the worst finishing since this sentence. Also off, the Saudis, who typically bombed in the middle of another country's celebrations. And the day was rounded off with drama on the telly as Spain got a scare off Team Melli. Thursday from 1, there's more World Cup fun with Group C, Denmark taking on Australia in Samara. Then from 4, France against Peru in Ekaterinburg. And in the evening, the big one, Argentina-Croatia in Nizhny Novgorod. It's all coming up in Totally Football Show at the World Cup. Yes, hello from World Cup land, listener. We're joined today by Matt Davis. Hello, Matt.
Hello, James.
Tom Williams is here too.
Hello, James.
And so is Jack Lang.
Good evening.
Hello to you all. Interesting day, Wednesday. Interesting. Kind of reached a crescendo at the end, though, with the big kind of Iran-Spain thing. But before that, slightly flat. It was almost like the honeymoon was slightly over. The first guests were departing, in this case Morocco and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and heading home to their day jobs. But equally, we did get the first teams through, and then we got that tremendously exciting match at the end, which kind of made up for it all.
Yeah, a bit of a slow burner. We're still on no 0-0 draws for the competition, which is obviously great, but it didn't really feel like that today because certainly the first two 1-0s were about as boring as 1-0s get. But, as you say, redeemed to an extent by Iran-Spain, which was oddly compelling in that Iran set their stall out early, packed 11 men behind the ball, and at every available opportunity flopped to the ground without the need for any sort of real provocation. Ordinarily, you'd condemn that. But when the team on the receiving end contains Diego Costa and Sergio Ramos and Jordi Alba, I won't go on.
Plus, it was just such a huge mismatch as well. It felt that way in terms of FIFA rankings and the like. Yeah, it was an interesting game. We'll come on to that in a second. Of course, also later on in the show, we'll be having a look at the matches on Thursday, why they're going to be great, and we'll be hearing from some of the global Totally family on things to watch out for in those. But the scores then on Wednesday, Morocco beaten 1-0 by a pretty lacklustre Portugal, Ronaldo getting his fourth goal of this cup, Morocco now out, as we mentioned. Uruguay put two teams out, remarkably, Saudi Arabia, who they beat in Rostov, and Egypt, whose exit is also confirmed by that result. And back in Group B, it was Franco's lament, Iran-Spain. Diego Costa winning that one, 1-0. And one thing I should mention, actually, I don't know if you heard Shireen talking about the passion that all parts of Iranian society feel for the game of football. Last night on Totally. Interested to note that women and families were allowed entrance to the Azadi Stadium in Tehran to watch this match on the big screens there after 37 years of being banned. So that's absolutely terrific. Sadly, events on the field didn't go quite their way. Obviously not sadly from Spain's point of view. Was it a fair result in the end, Jack, that 1-0 win?
I would say just about, yes, because Spain, especially in the first half, dominated the ball. Iran had clearly a very conservative game plan, especially in the first half, which was to keep 11 men behind the ball. I thought they did it very well, actually. In the second half, when they'd fallen behind, they came out and made a bit of a game of it, and I was quite impressed with them, really. I think by no means will that be a walkover for Portugal in their last game.
Right.
But I think Spain probably would argue that on balance of play, they just about did enough to win, even though it was an enormously scrappy goal. And you might wonder whether the system, especially to play a team like Iran, who are always going to sit back. There are a couple of decisions made by Hierro that are fairly questionable. Costa, aside from his very fortunate goal, didn't really seem to be the player to work in those tight spaces, didn't really combine too much with his teammates. And the same for Lucas Vasquez, I think, who is a player who exploits space, uses his speed, and there really wasn't any space to exploit here. Mm. So I think he was quite ineffective. And Spain, despite, I think, shading the balance of play, probably also a touch lucky considering the nature of the goal.
Lack of reaction from the novice Spain manager.
Yeah, which I guess is forgivable. But, you know, Diego Costa, we were sitting in the office watching the game and we all thought maybe it was more of an Aspas game, but he's the player who's got the winning goal in the end, even though there was a stroke of luck to it. And 9 in 9 in his last nine international starts for Spain is pretty impressive.
3 shots on target, 3 goals.
Well, ruthlessly efficient.
You make your own luck in this game.
Are we that shot? I mean, I know he scored, but he didn't exactly shoot a goal, did he?
He didn't move his leg toward the ball, did he?
I know it came off his knee, but I might have to quibble that one with the Opta lads.
All right. Iran had made a bit of a go of it. They had a cracking chance just before Spain scored, and then afterwards, hearts of flutter as they buried the ball in the side netting, and then even scored, but then had it called back for offside.
Yeah, really dramatic final stages. I think they deserve a great deal of credit for coming on so strongly in the end, because for a long stretch of the game, it looked as though they didn't have the tools to really push that Spain backline. But when they showed a little bit more attacking intent, I thought they were very good. And Spain actually looked quite rattled at the end. We saw Karim Anzafarad had the ball in the side netting, looked like a goal. I was celebrating it, as to much amusement in the office there. Kind of the Raheem Sterling of this World Cup, if you will, wild celebrations. And then, yes, I think the decision for their ruled out goal was the correct one. I think we can all agree, but a bit of a scare for Spain.
And to finish off the game, a little bit of fun for us all, that wonderful forward roll throw in.
Milad Mohammadi, take a bow, for it was he who, deep into stoppage time, with his team desperately trying to find the equaliser that would keep their World Cup hopes alive, decides that this is the time to attempt an acrobatic somersault throw-in, misjudges his landing completely, lands about a foot short of the touchline, decides actually he's not going to go through with it, backs up a bit and throws the ball in normally.
Right.
Video footage is already flashing around the world. So
probably cost them, a minute or so?
I don't know, perhaps a minute, maybe 30 seconds or so, yeah. But, you know, gave us all a laugh, so he's done something. Can't put a price on comedy.
He also has the nickname, I've just done a bit of cursory research, he's nicknamed Mig-Mig, which is the, I guess, the foreign language version of Beep Beep, which is Roadrunner.
Right.
So perhaps understandable that there was some Looney Tunes action in the end there.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Okay, well, that's certainly going to make for an interesting final set of games there in Group B. Elsewhere, Portugal took on Morocco in a match fans are hailing as slightly better than Uruguay-Saudi Arabia. So let's talk about that one now. Poor old Morocco, they're out. And here's Gavin saying, how did Morocco go from the nation that qualified without conceding to the team that left without scoring? Matt.
Yeah, lots of egg on faces, isn't there? Because they were pretty much everybody's dark horse, Morocco, and they've become the first team to be eliminated. Though, I mean, Mehdi Benatia will still be wondering how his team didn't get at least one goal in this game, and he could have had a hat-trick. He's got over 50 caps, 2 goals. He should have at least doubled that in this one match on its own. It was extraordinary the way the chances just fell to him, seemingly, for Morocco, and it's something I'm sure...
Well, one fell to Belunda, who forced a terrific save from Wolves-bound Rui Patricio.
But all the Benatia ones seemed to be off target, and that was a fabulous save from Rui Patricio, but a lot for Hervé Renard to lament over the course of the tournament, really.
Should Morocco have had a penalty in this game? When was it Fonte who slammed...
Taib, slightly. I think it was one of those I can see given either way. But I was quite frustrated by Morocco, I have to say, because there's clearly so much potential there. Yet their decision-making in the final third was often quite haywire. The mitigating circumstances there are that they lack a really top-class finisher to put the ball in the net. They've got a lot of creators. But those guys in behind who are obviously so talented, Belonda and Zayac, their final ball was, I thought, really poor most of the time. And even at the end, when they desperately needed a goal, they weren't really carving out opportunities aside from the ones that fell to Benatia. So, a bit disappointed.
What about Portugal, who I think a lot of people found disappointing? Are they, as, for example, Tom Condor at Portugal suggests, going to only start playing well when they face a decent side again?
I mean, quite possibly. That's what happened at the Euro. And you could even argue that they didn't even really play well in the entire tournament and still ended up winning it. So this is a formula that's worked for them in the past. I mean, against Morocco were basically the better team for the entire game, bar the 5 seconds it took for João Moutinho to put a corner in the box and Ronaldo to score his fourth goal of the tournament. Apart from that, Portugal looked really poor. They didn't hold on to the ball in midfield. I thought Bernardo Silva had a very poor game. Nordin Amrabat recovered from, or perhaps not recovered, from his slightly curious concussion incident in Morocco's first game, gave Rafael Guerreiro an absolute chasing on Portugal's left. And it was hard to believe you were watching a team that had won their last major tournament and that had done so well against Spain as well. But as we know in tournaments, it doesn't matter how well you play in the group stage. And there's even an argument for keeping your powder dry as far as possible. And, you know, Portugal are on their way to the last 16, and maybe then we'll see them start to turn it on a bit more.
The whole day's felt like a bit of a throwback, really. You've got Uruguay with their very rigid 80s-style 4-4-2. Then you've got Portugal reprising the class of 2016. And then basically a game straight out of South Africa 2010 to end the day with Spain passing the opposition to death and Vuvuzelas providing the soundtrack. Right. It's been a strange day in that way, really. Mm. But we ought to give a mention to Ronaldo, another record. Top scorer in men's European international football with 85, one ahead of Puskas. Still got a way to catch Ali Dai of Iran. He's the leading men's European international football scorer.
With 85 goals.
85, one ahead of Puskas. Ali Dia, 109, the world leader.
Right. Lots of people tweeting about this. Duncan Alexander, Ronaldo now has as many World Cup goals as Norway. Justin Bryant with an interesting take. He posits this scenario. Grandad, what was Ronaldo like? Oh, I spent his entire career irrelevantly comparing him to another player and snidely calling yet another player the real Ronaldo. It's true. People find a lot of reasons not to love CR7. I personally got a massive soft spot for him.
Me too, yeah. I mean, anybody who has zero self-awareness, I always think that there's something quite endearing about that in a strange way, and he definitely comes into that category.
His goatee, is that a direct reference to the Lionel Messi Goat magazine cover?
It must be. Come on. He's not had facial hair since a very unconvincing bum fluff experiment.
But it's a Euro strange thing. I mean, it's not like Goat is a. I mean, that's not how you say it.
Celebrate his first goal against Spain with the slightly peculiar chin stroking, and now this goatee is suddenly.
Well, maybe
appeared.
That was the first whiskers coming through, and it is itchy. But you have some inside information on this, Tom?
Well, apparently Ronaldo's explanation for his new facial adornment is that it came from a conversation he had with Ricardo Quaresma before the Spain game. I think they were sitting in a sauna, which I assume is something to do
I'm
with...
I'm getting Top Gun vibes on this.
Big, very strong Top Gun vibes. And one of them said, oh, if you score against Spain, you should grow a little goatee or something like that. And lo and behold, he did. But I'm not convinced. I think there's more to this. I'm waiting to see how he appears for the third group game. If there's anything goatee about his appearance, a couple of little synthetic horns perhaps, we'll know that something's afoot.
Just goes to show that even at the age of 34, Ricardo Quaresma can still influence a major tournament.
Yeah. I'd like to see a bit more Ricardo Quaresma.
He's great.
Possibly in the clash with Iran. Okay, Portugal, do a Portugal on Morocco, and that sets up a really interesting final set of games in Group B. Group A, meanwhile, that's all sorted already. Uruguay's 1-0 win, courtesy of Luis Suarez over Saudi Arabia and Rostov, means that they and Russia are through and Saudi Arabia and Egypt are out. And, well, Sasha in yesterday's show was suggesting that he didn't fancy Russia's chances much against Uruguay, but based on this performance, I think you probably might disagree, Matt.
Well, yeah, and based on the fact that Sasha said that, I would tend to think the opposite of what he said, given the way his predictions have gone so far. But yeah, Uruguay, it's sort of been disappointing in both games. I mean, this was the second half in particular was really bad, maybe the worst we've seen in the tournament so far. But it's the first time they won their opening two games at the World Cup since 1954. So but maybe they're not doing as badly as I think. I find them quite a difficult team to judge at the moment.
But their opposition in these opening two games, what, a Salahist Egypt and now Saudi Arabia, it's probably the easiest opening fixtures they've had.
Yeah, that's true. And it's all quite stodgy, and there doesn't seem to be the link-up between Cavani and Suarez that I'm sure Tabárez is looking for. But again, as Tom said earlier, you don't want to be peaking in game two of the tournament. So if you're not playing well and you're winning anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Uruguay famously like it when the going is tough. So I think there's probably the feeling that a game against a tougher opponent, I don't know whether Russia would count as that level of opponent, but certainly in the knockout stages, I think that would be more likely to bring the best out of them. This was, a fairly rancid game, I think, and I don't think there was much there to encourage Uruguay, but I don't think it would necessarily be a good barometer for the kind of game they'll play against in the knockout stage.
Before we move on from Wednesday's action, there were a lot of question marks over Portugal's back line and a lot of people suggesting that was their weak spot. In the game against a Morocco team who dominated possession but couldn't score, do we actually owe them a little bit of praise?
To a degree, yes. I think they were helped by the fact that Morocco just don't have the sharp cutting edge that a team of their level need to make any sort of impression at a tournament like this. As Jack was saying, they've got lots of talent in the attacking midfield roles, but they had Boutayeb up front today and he didn't really pose any sort of threat. So it wasn't like Pepe and Jose Font had their hands full the whole game. But yeah, you know, I suppose you have to give them credit for marshalling a defence that didn't concede any goals. And on the few occasions when Morocco did get in behind, then, you know, Rui Patricio stood up with a couple of saves. But you'd still worry for Portugal with that slightly creaky back line coming up against forwards with a bit more nous, particularly when people like, you know, Guerreiro at left back are having absolute shockers.
Yeah. All right.
Some classic Pepe action at the end of the game which was, you don't want to see that kind of thing, but you really do, don't you? I mean, it's sort of quite funny. Benatia just with a sarcastic pat on the back and him throwing himself to the ground and Martin Keown lamenting the time when men used to be men. And yeah.
Yeah.
Great stuff, Pepe.
Classic World Cup scenes. Yeah. We all look back on the Rivaldo incident from 2002 with affection, and no doubt in years to come this will be revisited similarly. That's Wednesday anyway. After this, Thursday.
Listeners, even your good friends here at the Totally Football Show need to take a break from the football every now and then, and that's why we read The Economist, and you can too, for free, by texting the word football to 78070. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. Since 1843, the magazine's been covering a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, arts and even sport. For example, there's an article in a recent issue which crunches the numbers to investigate why goalkeepers are undervalued. I've read it, and that's why I can tell you that in the past four transfer windows, strikers bought by some of the biggest clubs in the world have cost 17.1 million euro on average, which works out at around 8.5 million euro a point, whereas goalkeepers have cost 6.5 million euro per head at a slightly higher rate of 9.4 million euro a point. The conclusion? Keepers cost less than forwards, not because they're underappreciated, but because they are less valuable. And it's nuggets like that that helps Economist readers prepare for what's going on in the world around them. A world in which facts count more than ever. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. Get your free print copy now. Just text football to 78070.
Coming up in your exciting World Cup 2018, 1 o'clock, Group C gets back underway as Denmark take on Australia out east in Samara. Staying with that group, 4 o'clock, it's France against Peru. That's an exciting game. We'll be hearing a little bit about the Peruvian perspective on it very shortly, the game being played in Ekaterinburg, which is even Easter. And then at 7 o'clock, this could be very, very, very dramatic indeed. Group D, Argentina, held to that 1-1 draw by Iceland, take on Croatia in Nizhny Novgorod, which is a short hop northeast of Moscow. So then, France against Peru. The besashed Peruvians have won hearts, I think, for the passion they brought to the streets of Russian cities and on the pitch as well in their unfortunate 1-0 defeat against Denmark. How are they going to fare against Les Bleus? Well, we dialed up the co-host of Sports Illustrated TV's Planet Football, Luis Miguel Echegaray, to get his take. Luis, how are you?
I'm good, Jimbo. Thanks for having me on your awesome show.
We're delighted that you could join us. We're so excited to see Peru in action again on Thursday in this huge game against France. How do you think Gareca's going to go for this? Is he going to go all out for the win, which you desperately need, or is it going to be a cautious affair?
I think you might get a little bit of both, Jimbo. If we know anything about Gareca, is that he's a tactical, smart, patient man who times his pressing and his possession game and defending all within one match. I don't think you're just going to see one single type of tactic. We may hold at the beginning, feel them out a little bit, maybe tire them. And then as the game progresses, then Gareca might have to start thinking about the fact that we need to, you know, cause some havoc. But I don't think that's the beautiful thing about Ricardo Gareca. He's not a type of manager where you just get a plan A. He has a plan A to plan F, I guess. So, you know, I think that's what you're going to get.
You saw France's game against Australia, I imagine, Luis.
Yes.
Do you think they can be beaten by Peru?
Well, Jimbo, I'll tell you something. Before the tournament even started, I tweeted and reported, and I guess somebody asked me somewhere else. And I actually said that, listen, I'm not going to be, you know, obviously naive and say that France is not a favorite in this group with the talent that they have. But Australia, in terms of what they offered against a team like Peru and what we do, Australia actually worried me more than France. And that kind of proved my point in that first game with France and Australia, where, yes, we know the individual talent that France has. But to me, Didier Deschamps is like a man that just found a pot of gold and he just threw it in the ocean. I really don't think that he has been able to create a cohesive unit, and he's relying more on the flair and individual talent of like Antoine Griezmann or Paul Pogba, Mbappé. I think that this game actually suits us better because it will be more open and we'll be able to create better avenues and better spaces. So I'm not saying we're going to win. I'm cautiously optimistic, but I have such a belief in Ricardo Gareca, one of the most underrated managers in the world, that there is definitely a realistic possibility that we can cause some damage.
Wow. Okay. How big a deal is being in the World Cup for Peru?
Oh, Jimbo, it's if I could write you a poem right now or sing you a song or show you something. I mean, it's honestly, you can't even put it into words. 36 long years. Many of us have never even seen Peru at the World Cup. We have memories and tales from our parents and grandparents of the good days of the 70s and 80s. And that's also mixed with the political climate that happened during that period, just being kind of the laughing stock of South America for many years. There was so much talent, but no discipline. There was a lot of will, but no execution. It just means everything, everything. And you can see it. You can see it in videos of fans over there in Peru or in Russia. You can just see the passion and what it feels to everybody. It's very hard to describe because it really is more than just the World Cup. It's just an opportunity for Peruvians to celebrate the fact that we are good enough to be here.
How many Peruvian fans are there in Russia, do you think?
I was reading a few things and listening to some reports. The estimates at that around that time was approximately between 50 and 60,000. And I think that number is probably higher given the fact that there's a lot of Peruvian Americans, you know, Peruvians coming from the US or Peruvians from around the world. So the number's pretty high up.
Many thanks to Luis Miguel Ichigaray, who you can see in SITV's Planet Football. So Peru aiming high for this one, as indeed Cueva, of course, was in the game against Denmark. That was such a shame, wasn't it? Because he had such a great game.
Yes, he had a very good game aside from that unfortunate miss, and he was understandably crestfallen. I'm sure he's had a few sleepless nights since. The question for Peru is where the goals are going to come from. I don't think Jefferson Farfán had a particularly effective game up front in the game against Denmark. And I think there's a strong likelihood that Paulo Guerrero, who is actually Farfán's childhood friend, they go back a long way, will replace him in the starting lineup. I think Gareca said it's one or the other. Guerrero is Peru's top scorer ever, obviously coming back from his ban.
He looked good in the half hour that he came on against Denmark.
He did. He's a focal point. I think that's what the team needs. They've got a lot of pace and a lot of trickery around him. And sometimes you need someone who will just stand in the penalty area, be a bit of a lump. He's very good in the air as well, which is something the rest of the team don't have. The slight couple of injury concerns for them, Renato Tapia, the very influential central midfielder, got a bang on the head against Denmark. And both he and Andre Correa, who's also excellent, have trained separately the last couple of days. Either one of those missing out would be a huge blow.
Okay. Interesting question as well for Gareca. Does he go for it? They almost certainly need the win. The only way 4 points would be enough is if Denmark and Australia draw in a series of other events. They kind of have to go for it here. Do they have the talent to really scare the French, a France team indeed that didn't impress in their opener with Australia?
Yeah, Didier Deschamps had to go back to the drawing board. I've spoken about this in some of the preview shows, but his hope was that this fluid front three of Griezmann, Mbappe and Dembele would click. It hasn't. They were very disappointing against Australia. Didn't really start playing any football until Olivier Giroud came on, and there's no surprise that he looks like he's going to start against Peru. It also looks like Blaise Matuidi is going to come back into the team, who has been one of Deschamps' most trusted lieutenants, so he'll give them a bit more industry. One of the things that was really lacking against Australia was any pressing from the attacking players, and that seems to have been quite a big issue after the game. Reports of Deschamps questioning his attacking players as to why they weren't working harder to close down Australia's defenders, and being told in response, well, we didn't do that enough in training, we weren't sure what we were supposed to be doing. So a few potential issues there. I think one area that will concern France is the knowledge that the last team that beat them was Colombia, back at, in a friendly at the Stade de France in March. A team quite similar to Peru in many ways, with a big figurehead centre-forward, Falcao for Colombia, Guerrero as it looks like it's going to be for Peru, and then a lot of tricky technical players around him. Carrillo, who we didn't see a huge amount of at Watford last season, very impressive in Peru's opening game against Denmark. Flores on the other flank, and Cueva, who we've talked about as well. So there is a bit of nervousness, I think, in the French camp, and it looks like Deschamps is going to revert to type. He's going to go back to the 4-2-3-1 system that he used during the Euro, with Griezmann playing just off Giroud, Matuidi adding a bit more ballast in midfield, and hoping that that, you know, that sorts out their problems.
All right. You make a good case for Peru here, but what do you think's going to happen, Tom?
It's really hard to say with France, because I didn't see anything in that game against Australia that gave me any real optimism for them, apart from the fact that when Giroud came on, the link-up play got a little bit better. We know that Griezmann prefers playing with him. Mbappe showed in fits and starts what he can do. I find it really hard to call this game. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a draw, if France dropped points. I mean, they were fortunate to beat Australia. It took a contentious penalty and one of the most, you know, one of the most fortuitous goals that we've seen at the World Cup so far. You know, Pogba having the ball sort of kicked off his toe by an Australia defender and looping about an inch over the line. So I can see France dropping points here. And if they do, it might not be a disaster. But it's really hard to say where they are at the moment.
OK. Well, the other game in that group sees Australia, who certainly had the performance in their opener, take on a Denmark team who maybe didn't have the performance, but certainly had the points. A low-scoring one in prospect, would you say, Matt?
It certainly feels that way, yeah. A theme of this World Cup seems to be the importance of having a striker, an out-and-out striker, something which we haven't seen in recent tournaments. You think if France are going to go for Giroud, that they're thinking that way. But you look at the goal scorers today, Ronaldo, Costa and Suarez, three big-name frontmen, and that's what Denmark in particular are lacking, but Australia too. From what we saw against France, other than maybe an Aaron Moy free kick, finding somebody or a penalty, a moment of madness from Ntiti, it's very difficult to see how Australia can score in open play against a Denmark team that's got such a good defence right now. Kasper Schmeichel, what, more than 500 minutes since he's last conceded a goal, matches without letting one in. So
last team to score against him, Republic of Ireland.
Yeah, in the playoff, which they won handsomely anyway. So difficult to make a case for Australia here, and difficult to make a case for anything other than maybe the kind of game that we've seen today, a sort of fairly tepid, low-scoring affair.
The Danes can actually qualify from this match. Socceroos absolutely must win. A little bit of team news. William Quist has been sent home with two broken ribs. Ouch.
That's okay, because their key player has never been Quist.
Okay. Never been Quist. Very nice.
I'd laugh more, but you did that on Twitter the other day.
Hey, a good joke is a good joke forever.
But another player who did go home has come back again.
Yes, Jonas Knudsen, who I believe I'm right in saying didn't play in the first game, but his had a baby daughter born slightly prematurely, and the other members of the squad very kindly all chipped together to get him a private jet back so he could be with her. And I think he's now returned to the squad. So I'm sure that has gone down very well.
Excellent. Australia absolutely must win this game to stay in with a chance of making the last 16. The Danes can already qualify with a victory here.
Sun, sea, sand and football. Watching the World Cup on holiday sounds like paradise, until you try watching a game online and realise seconds before kickoff that it's blocked. Well, instead of bemoaning your decision to book a trip during a tournament that comes around once every 4 years, you need to get yourself a virtual private network from bestvpn.com. and you'll be able to access the internet freely wherever you are this summer, all for less than the price of a pint. Because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can get 70% off a VPN by visiting bestvpn.com/podcast. BestVPN.com will set you up with a VPN in minutes so you can watch the football from your deck chair or by the pool. And when it comes to security, BestVPN.com will also protect your internet activity from prying eyes on open Wi-Fi networks. No matter where you are in the world, you can access your online home comforts with a VPN, so unlock the internet today with BestVPN.com. Find out more and get 70% off by heading to BestVPN.com/podcast.
Thursday also sees Group D returning with a very intriguing Argentina-Croatia match. Croatia will no doubt be more relaxed than the Argentines coming into this after the Argentines could only manage a 1-1 draw in their opener with Iceland. Messi missed a penalty, or had one saved, to be fair. And as usual, their attack just stuttered, which it's been doing all the way through the qualifying. Jack, they've got an amazing squad, a pool of goal-scoring talent. They've also got the amazing Leo Messi. And just the fact of having him on the field, if he doesn't score, you'd think that because the opposition, like Iceland, stick three men on him, the likes of Aguero or whoever else, Higuain or whoever else is up there, is going to be piling the goals on. Why does it not happen like that for Argentina?
I think you have to look at the tactics and you have to look at the disruptions that there have been over the last few years. There have been They had three different managers in qualifying. That disrupts things. Each of them has their own ideas. Even since Jorge Sampaoli took control, he's tried a number of different systems. We're going to see a different system in this game against Croatia to the one we saw in the first game. All of that means that it's hard for the players to build up relationships between themselves. A lot of players get used for Argentina. The number of options that you've alluded to there means that one gets tried for two matches, another one comes in for three matches. Whereas compare them to the team they drew with in the first game, Iceland, who have picked largely the same group of players for 3-4 years now. They know each other's games inside out. Argentina have nowhere near that level of understanding between the players. And what it means is that in difficult situations when they need those like automatic passing options, they're not there. That means that they panic somewhat and they look for the easiest option, whose name is Lionel Messi. He's crowded out all the time. And I think it's just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They don't know what to do, so they look for Messi. Messi gets crowded out and they need another option. But the only other option they have is, again, look for Messi. It's a problem that's not going to go away quickly. And I think perhaps in Sampaoli, they have a coach who, given the time, would be able to find a reasonable solution to it. But time is something he hasn't had. This has been quite a rushed preparation because of the managerial changes. And yeah, it's just trying to organise a cogent team at short notice is just very difficult.
Well, it looks like what he's going to try and do to improve things in this clash with Croatia is bringing the Boca Juniors winger, Christian Pavon, who a lot of people, including yourself, Matt Davies, are very excited about.
Yeah. At the risk of being repeating myself, yeah, I really love this guy. And I think Jack hit the nail on the head after the Iceland game where he made the point about how everything goes through Messi. And I thought it was really interesting when Pavon came on that he didn't seem to be cowed by that at all. He was more than happy to take responsibility on himself, try and beat his man, get a cross in. He should have had a penalty. And it was just that kind of sort of impetuousness of youth, if you like, that means that he just doesn't appear to have that same weight on his shoulders of where's Messi. And I think even Messi said after he made his debut, this guy's great and I enjoy playing with him. But it would be a huge call for Sampaoli to put Pavon in at the expense of Di Maria would be the natural position to put him in. And obviously, I mean, Di Maria
would that be a huge call? Has Di Maria been
only in terms of the fact that it's Di Maria?
Yeah.
And Pavon is a 22-year-old kid who's just had his first breakthrough season. But Di Maria was particularly ineffective against Iceland, I thought. So, you know, if Pavon gets the chance from the start, I would back him to justify his selection.
This business of time with Sampaoli, a run in the cup, might we start to see Argentina making something of these incredible ingredients they have?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, a lot can gel in a short period of time. We were talking about Peru earlier, and actually a lot of Peru's game plan really came together during a couple of Copa America campaigns, during which they gelled probably more than expected, and they actually had long periods together. Sampaoli is up against it, obviously, because not only is he looking to find a system that works, but obviously there's a massive amount of pressure on him, and the Argentine media is not particularly forgiving. And you've got obviously Diego Maradona coming out and wading in with his oar and saying that, oh, it was shameful against Iceland, and a failure to beat Croatia would mean Sampaoli would not be welcome home, things like this. So I think in countries like Argentina and Brazil, there's an added level of cattiness, I would say, that doesn't help the managerial situation, that maybe isn't present in, you know, a Peru or a Colombia.
Mm. Well, Croatia, meanwhile, who come into this game top of the group, albeit after just one game, have one or two issues of their own. You may have read about the fan boycott, a lot of fans saying that they're not going to support the team at the World Cup, while the ruling clique in the Croatian FA remains out of jail. There's various banners that have been cited on social media in Croatia saying, may you all lose, this kind of thing. And this centres around the ongoing scandal regarding the activities of Zdravko Mamic, who was the head of Croatian football, previously Dinamo Zagreb, and then the Croatian FA, and the way that money disappeared in the transfers of the likes of Luka Modric and Dejan Lovren, both of whom are now facing trial for perjury after taking the stand in Mamic's defence. And as a result, shall we say that the fans have fallen out of love with these two star players. To find out a little bit more on the whole situation, and indeed how it's possibly affecting the team as they head into this huge match with Argentina, to find out a little bit more about this very unfortunate situation and how it might impact on the team in Thursday night's game, we dialed up the Telesport commentator, Juraj Vrduljak. Juraj, thanks for joining us. First of all, what is the position that Luka Modric is in now?
Well, it's really a bizarre one, because on one hand, you have best player in the current setup. Not only in the current setup, he's probably one of the best players in Croatian football history. But on the other hand, you have a player that is facing even prison time because of his giving a false testimony in the Mamic trial case. He is now charged with perjury, and he could be facing from 6 months up to 5 years in prison. That's actually the thing that divides the Croatian society. Should we let a person not only who's facing prison time, but even worse, who try to lie only to cover the people who are responsible for the situation, for this toxic atmosphere in the Croatian football? Or should we just give him a pass and let people see him only as a player who shouldn't be involved in these kind of disputes? It's hard to say. Personally, I fully understand people who do not want him to be the national team captain, because he could use his influence to perhaps clear things up, to raise this really bad shadow over Croatian football. But instead, he chose to stand with the people who are responsible for the whole situation.
He's regarded as such a key player for Croatia. Do you see this affecting his performance?
It'll obviously cross his mind on a daily basis, because even though the trial date has not yet been set for Luka Modric, it's really not only a heavy offense, but on the other hand, it's something that undermines his status in Croatian football history. He is one of the best players ever, but on the other hand, he'll definitely be remembered as the one that tried to cover the big boss, the big bad boss and the top villain of the Croatian football in his farcical testimony in front of the court.
In the meantime, you're in a big game against Argentina. How optimistic are you about the team's chances?
People actually expect that Croatia can pull out a victory. But also, people expect formation to be slightly changed due to the fact that you cannot let the Argentine midfield run you over, and Nigeria didn't actually exploit the middle of the pitch whereas they could.
Juraj Vrduljak of Telesport there. What a story that is, Tom.
Indeed, yes.
Very sad, isn't it? Because you think of Croatia traditionally as being one of the teams with the closest bond to their supporters. So it's, I mean, I'm going back 20 years maybe with that, but that sort of magic 98 World Cup finish third, it was all about the bond between the players and the supporters, wasn't it? And couldn't be further from the truth now.
Right, not right now. Luka Modric, meantime, a lot of people were saying how Zlatko Dalic, the new manager, shifted him forward to a more of a number 10 role. That was supposedly the plan, but there wasn't much of that in the Nigeria game, which was not a great performance.
No, he played a bit deeper, played alongside Ivan Rakitic. We all know that Croatia's talent pool is deepest in midfield. We saw that, I think, in that game against Nigeria, where Croatia always looked in control, just didn't really make many chances. They had two shots on target, one of which was a penalty, and the opening goal was an own goal. Ivan Perisic, I thought, had quite a good game and put in a couple of dangerous crosses in the second half, neither of which were converted. So while there's plenty of talent in that Croatian midfield, they're another team who look like they're lacking someone who can make the difference in tight matches up front.
They're certainly going to be lacking Nikola Kalinic after they sent him home for refusing to come on in the Nigeria game, supposedly because he had a bad back. Yeah. Rakitic, of course, is a teammate of Messi's at Barcelona. So he'll have special insider information on how to stop him.
In case any of his teammates aren't familiar with him.
Right. Are Croatia going to be better this time around, do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I think the pressure's off them to an extent, having got that first result and knowing that Argentina didn't. So I would actually think that Croatia might nick a win here.
Do you think so?
Mm. Wouldn't surprise me if they packed the midfield a bit more. I saw them against Brazil in the pre-tournament friendly and they played Milan Badeli of Fiorentina in a midfield three alongside Modric and Rakitic. That wouldn't necessarily be a bad move, given that Argentina are probably again going to be quite crowded through the middle. That kind of block would probably help them keep it quite tight, as they did against Brazil.
Mm. Brazil struggled to get past them, didn't they?
They did for a long time.
Special goal from Neymar to resolve that one. All right, Tom, what's your call on this?
Yeah, I mean, as Jack was saying, in Argentina, we saw that they had problems against Iceland, and you know there is a real feeling of an aeroplane being constructed and trying to be flown at the same time. Croatia clearly are a more settled team and have plenty of ability. You know, that there is a bit of a question mark, I think, about their efficiency in front of goal. But this feels like a good time to be playing Argentina.
Mm. Some upheaval, of course, for Croatia as well. Zlatko Dalic only recently taking over since qualification was earned, indeed, for the World Cup in Russia. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in that game and all of Thursday's fixtures. Let's find out now the odds on those games. Producer Ben speaking to Paddy Power.
Thanks, Jimbo. I'm back with Lee Price from Paddy Power. Lee, Denmark versus Australia kicks things off. What are the markets looking on that one?
Yeah, it's intriguing, this one. Denmark obviously in a good position after their first round victory. They're 8-11 to win the match. Australia so unlucky to lose to France, a very 21st century defeat. They're 7-2 to get 3 points here. And the draw, which seems to be the value for a lot of these second round fixtures, is 12-5 in this match.
France squeaked past Australia in their opening game. They were really, really not very good at all. Peru, unlucky, probably not to get something from their game with Denmark. What's going to happen in this one?
Yeah, I wonder if we're starting to see a pattern of the bigger teams faltered at the first game. A few plucky smaller teams were unlucky. Now it's time for judgments. Peru are quite a large 6-1 to get the result here. France are 1-2 and really do need to get an impressive performance with that. It's 16-5 for the draw, and odds on, I would say, that Paul Pogba is under more pressure after this match.
And the highlight for this day's games has got to be Argentina versus Croatia. Argentina were hopeless against Iceland. Croatia looked very, very tasty indeed. Is Leo Messi going to have a stinker?
Yeah, Argentina needs to replace the number 10, don't they? He's overrated. Argentina are evens to win this match. Messi and Argentina generally are 19-1 to miss a penalty again. Will Lionel bounce back? He's 40-1 to grab a hat-trick. Croatia 11-4 to win this match, and it's 23-10 the draw. But Croatia, after years of being sort of dark horses and this year being written off as past it, have finally started to show some material. I quite like them.
You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com. It's 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. Do tweet us, listeners, at The Totally Show with your questions and comments. On Facebook, you'll find videos, quizzes, competitions, and more. And, of course, we'll have a new Totally Football Show at the World Cup for you after they wrap things up between Argentina and Croatia. Matt, any final thoughts before we press stop?
I think tomorrow's going to be better than today.
Thursday better than Wednesday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hope so. Although, I mean, if things gently build up crescendo-like as they did today, and then Argentina-Croatia's a real cracker, I'd take that.
Yeah. If today turns out to be the low point of this World Cup, it'll be a pretty good World Cup.
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, nice one.
If someone else could attempt a somersault throw-in at an inappropriate moment as well, that would also go down well.
It wasn't Iran's first weird throw-in either, because in the first game, Vahed Amiri, who I believe is kind of left-sided player, twice lined up for a long throw with an insanely long run-up and then did a tiny little mini one to a team that had come close. So they're obviously home-brewing some pretty spectacular throw-in routines.
Messing with the opposition's minds.
Yeah.
Interesting. Love it. All right, nice one. Well, guys, thank you so much for being with us this evening. Listener, thank you for your participation. We'll catch up with you in 24. Have a great time till then.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. Subscribe now and get the latest episode delivered right to your phone for free. And seeing as you're still here, here's an extract from the new Gazette in Italy audiobook. It's written by Daniel Story, read by James Richardson, and published by HarperCollins. Have a listen, and if you like what you hear, you can download it from iTunes or Audible for just £4.99. Remember, it's exclusively an audiobook, and it's called Gazza in Italy.
Gascoigne's ability to succeed in the role of clown prince made him popular not just with Lazio supporters, but across Serie A. Atalanta fans created a banner for when they played Lazio with a huge bottle of beer and the welcome, "This one is for you, Gazza." And that was a fairly consistent message. Even Roma supporters, their weight jibes aside, would concede that Gascoigne was a wonderful character to have at a club. If Lazio's aim when buying Gascoigne was to buy a player who would make their supporters love the club a little bit more than they had before, then it was a roaring success. At every home game at the Stadio Olimpico since he departed, there has been a banner on the Curva Nord bearing Gascoigne's image. If Gascoigne's popularity with Lazio supporters was never in doubt, his relationship with some of his teammates was far less certain. Italian footballers hardly have a reputation for glumness, but the stereotype is that they pride themselves on professionalism and personal fitness. As Sir Alex Ferguson is quoted as saying in Gabriele Marcotti's The Italian Job, Italian players have, or at least had, a greater respect than the English for their profession. They enter a system that has a certain discipline, and it has been that way in Italy for 30 to 40 years. Clubs elsewhere copied the Italians. If there were times when Gascoigne was a professional by technicality rather than behaviour, was there not a chance that his antics might antagonise his teammates? Does a dressing room really need a clown when the business of winning is so serious? Yet here again, the strength and warmth of Gascoigne's humanity won out. With the exception of Germans Thomas Doll and Karl-Heinz Riedler, who reportedly complained to the club that Gascoigne was being afforded special treatment, there is almost no insinuation that Gascoigne was anything other than a highly popular teammate. Perhaps this is because the other players didn't actually tend to socialise much with Gascoigne, or because he was a perfect lightning rod for media intrusion in a country where cameras and microphones continually evade the personal space of famous footballers. But most likely, it is because Gascoigne was and is a man it is impossible to dislike, a vulnerable soul, but a kind and generous one too. Still, there must have been times when Gascoigne's joker persona tested the patience of his teammates. One well-known tale concerns Roberto Di Matteo, who reached into his pocket after Gascoigne had asked to borrow some change and found his hand making contact with a live snake. Gascoigne had found it in the garden of his villa after the morning training session and realised that it could be the perfect prop for an afternoon practical joke. When appointed Chelsea manager in 2012, Di Matteo recalled the incident and his disbelief still lingered. "I think anybody would react. I didn't think he was that crazy to put a live snake into my pocket. I didn't go near it because I'm so afraid of snakes. He did a lot of things, a lot of stuff. My God, some crazy stuff." There was also an occasion when Gascoigne had not turned up for training. As the team bus pulled into the training ground, he was seen lying by the side of the road with a motorbike on top of him, covered in blood. It was not until several teammates had run to his side that Gascoigne burst out laughing, stood up, and pointed to a large amount of tomato ketchup on his clothes. The Italian players must have wondered who on earth had arrived at their club. "He was a man with the heart and eyes of a child," said Pierluigi Casiraghi, probably intending that as both compliment and insult. "We were on the team bus once and he sat down behind Zoff. As soon as the bus went into a dark tunnel, he stripped off all of his clothes and just sat there, waiting for Zoff to turn around and see him naked." Yet most obvious in the anecdotes of his Lazio teammates is the unanimous surprise, not at Gascoigne's japery, but his extreme generosity. It became a tradition for him to present the squad's younger members with presents. Alessandro Nesta recalls being given 5 pairs of shoes and a fishing kit, while Gascoigne gave Marco Di Vaio an expensive camera. Gascoigne was not a materialistic person, but he understood that others took pride in their possessions. His natural reaction, therefore, was to give things away to make others happy. No one could ever dislike Paul. He was so generous, said Signore, still a friend of Gascoigne today. If you ever said, Gazza, what a beautiful watch, where did you buy it? He would take it off and give it to you. To hear the full story of Gazza in Italy, download the exclusive audiobook on Audible or iTunes.